Hello and welcome to a podcast where we take fictional science from comics, movies, TV, etc. and try to make it factually, scientifically, possibly real. I'm Stoby.
I am known as Forgan.
And I'm Stu.
And this is The Science of Fiction.
Pick up the tricorder, put it on your head. Scanning the planet, see if anyone is dead. Autonomous car driving in Zanzibar. Beam me up, Scotty, I'm not that far. Android hoovering, tearing up the place. Flip phones and conference calls, friends in outer space. Astrophysicist sitting on my knee. Asking aliens if they like a cup of tea.
I've got an addiction to science fiction. I've got an addiction to science fiction. I've got an addiction, baby, to the science of fiction. I've got an addiction to the science of fiction.
Hello, gents.
Hello.
Hello.
What are we here to discuss today?
So we're going straight to the hammer down, are we? Oh, see what I did there?
Starting us off with the puns too.
Yeah,
that's nice.
Yeah, well, like hit the nail on the head there.
The level of dad jokage in this room is amazing right now.
That's all right. You just thought about it. Okay, so we're at three.
How many have you got left, right? You've got to bank some for the ends too, right?
Oh, I've got a million. It's genetic with me, remember?
Oh, dear.
So, as you know, the plan for this podcast is we're going to talk about various topics that are seen within sort of popular culture, media, comic books, TV, movies, things like that. So we thought we'd start off with something everyone sort of knows a little bit about. It's one of the biggest sort of things that's the sort of items that's come out of one of the biggest movie franchises of all time. It's Thor's hammer, Mjolnir. Now, obviously, everyone.
How did you say that?
Mjolnir.
It's Mjolnir.
I thought it was Mjolnir.
The J is the second letter. It's Mjolnir.
Oh, okay. I'm just used to Mjolnir. Okay,
I sound like a smart arse already.
Mjolnir.
We looked it up beforehand.
Yeah, we totally didn't do that at all.
It's fine. Like as expected, I am always completely unprepared. I'll say it how I want to say it. Anyway, Thor's hammer. The hammer belonging to Thor.
Yes.
Which obviously features in several of the MCU movies and pretty much all of his comics, I would imagine, apart from then somewhere he probably loses it or is removed from him.
Yeah, there are times where Thor doesn't have Mjolnir and he does get either Stormbreaker or, you know, he's
Blake.
When he becomes so after the, I think it's the original Sin storyline, Fury whispers something to him which makes him lose his confidence and he no longer feels worthy. So he can no longer wield Mjolnir. So he has alternatives. But you're right, it's predominantly in the Thor storyline, literally hand in handle with Thor. Straight from Wikipedia, we've got here just the definition is Mjolnir is a fictional mythical weapon appearing in American comic books published by Marvel Comics. It is depicted as the principal weapon of the superheroes Thor and Jane Foster, Lady Thor. Mjolnir, which first appears in Journey into Mystery 83, which was in August 1962.
That's it.
So Mjolnir's pretty old.
It looks good for it, though.
Yeah.
So is Mjolnir not in the original mythology of Thor? Because Thor is obviously a Norse god,
yes.
Right? Is Mjolnir
yes.
original?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And the story, the original Marvel story of how it was created is very close to the original mythology as well, with the explanation of the short handle and the dwarves making it and things like that. It was created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Joe Sinnott. It was typically depicted as a large, square-headed grey sledgehammer, and it has a short round handle wrapped in brown leather, culminating in a looped lanyard. The object is based on Mjolnir, the weapon of the mythological Thor. So, if you'd let me finish.
I do apologise.
So, there we have it. We have Mjolnir. And a little background on it.
Excellent.
So what are we going to talk about with Mjolnir?
So I my biggest questions, and I'm going to focus more on the exact physics of Mjolnir and making it. So I know that in the comics it's made of the mythical metal, Uru, which obviously doesn't necessarily exist in real world, but then maybe something similar to it. Mm. Now, throughout the MCU, we get the story that the Mjolnir is made from the heart of a dark star, or the heart of a dying star. Now, my first question is that possible?
Right.
What's at the heart of a dying star?
Right. Okay. So this is a great question because I'm an astrophysicist, so I can maybe answer this question.
This is why I came to you with this question. I mean, I know various doctors and writers, but I felt the astrophysicist was the person to come to with this question.
Right. Okay. So when you said to me it's made from the heart of a dying star, right, then the obvious candidate for what that would be is a neutron star. So a neutron star is what you get once a fairly massive star has ended its life and has gone off as a supernova, and the remains are this neutron star, and it's a star that's like the mass of the sun, but it's only, you know, 15 kilometers across, right? So if you think something that's the mass of the sun but would fit in between, well, it would fit in the central belt of Scotland, right, quite comfortably. So it's extremely dense, and it's made entirely of neutrons, and that's why it's called a neutron star. So a neutron star is incredibly dense. If you took a sugar cube of neutron star matter, it would weigh more than all the humans who are currently alive.
Really?
Yes.
No wonder he has such guns.
So this is the thing. Like, so if you look at the films and you see people trying to lift Thor's hammer, and it's like, yeah, it's like it's the super dense, you know, neutron metal. That makes kind of sense that maybe it's going to be hard to lift. The problem with that is that if it really was made of neutron star material, it would just go straight through the ground and right to the Earth's core and probably cause a massive nuclear explosion, and it would be pretty bad for all of us. So
that's pretty careless.
Yeah. Yes. Well, so, that's why we see in Thor 2 why the coat rack is worthy, because it can hold Mjolnir, whatever it's called. Yeah. Thor's hammer.
the thingy.
This will all go out in the edit. It'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, hope.
Yeah, so to answer your question, I think when you're talking about a dying star, it's a neutron star. People might talk about neutron stars as being dead, but they're not entirely dead. Like, they have strong magnetic fields. Things can happen around them. Neutron stars can even have planets that are formed around them. So some of the first planets ever found outside the solar system actually orbit a neutron star, which is pretty weird. So what probably happened was that the star formed and then some planets were made. The star lived its life and then died and went supernova and destroyed all the planets that were there. And then the remains were reassembled into new planets, which is pretty
far out. Sort of like how the moon happened, because the moon crashed into the Earth and then it sort of just hung around.
Yeah, so when the moon was formed, Earth was a little bit smaller than it is now, and it got hit by something about the mass of Mars, and the result of that collision was the Earth and the moon. So yeah, it's kind of similar, but a lot bigger. Yeah. I can see a hand up. Yes, Toby.
How do people even know this?
So it takes a lot of study of the rocks of the moon. So the geology of the moon and the Earth is really, really similar, like weirdly similar. So that's a big clue. We can also date the sort of formation epoch of the Earth and the Moon, and that comes from things like, basically the half-life of the different isotopes in the rocks, and so that helps us date things, a bit like carbon dating. And then to actually explain how all this works is essentially done in the computer. So they run computer simulations of different things that could happen, and one that people tend to gravitate to is this idea of there being two fairly big bodies that hit each other. And we know this happens to build planetary systems, right? So we know that this probably happens.
I like your use of gravitate there.
Yeah, see, I can do puns too as well.
There we go.
So that's kind of the way that astronomers have figured this out. And it seems to be that's why we have a moon, and that's why it's quite a big moon. If you look at other moons in the solar system, especially for like the terrestrial planets like Mercury and Venus and Mars, Mercury and Venus don't have moons, and Mars has two tiny little moons that are basically just like lumps of rock. So Earth seems to be quite lucky in that this happened at some point, and the result of the collision was two objects rather than just, you know, a belt of debris around the Earth or just nothing at all, right? Which could also happen.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So in summary of the question,
yeah,
the heart of a dying star could exist. It does exist.
Oh, it does exist. It's out there.
It has a form.
Yeah.
It would be super dense.
Yes.
Which is something I think it's a super dense metal. Thank you for confirming that. I feel super smart.
It's the densest thing that can possibly exist. if it got much denser than that, it'd be a black hole. So
yeah,
it's super dense.
It would also be very difficult to lift. So they've sort of actually nailed that on pretty well.
Yes.
My next question it would be: would you be able to take that super dense metal or that super dense that item and forge it into something? Like, for example, a hammer. I mean, and to follow and to sort of add on, what level of energy are you looking at to essentially smelt that metal? Because we see it in Infinity War. Mm. Obviously, there's the big sort of gyroscope thing around the star, which we'll come to in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I mean, how much energy are you talking about? I mean, just even to think about trying to melt that. Oh, yes,
hand up.
Yes, Toby, do you need to go to the toilet?
I was just gonna take a punt. That was all. not the energy question, but at the is it possible to mold it, you know, smelt it and mold it?
Yeah.
And I don't think it would be based on what we've just discussed and the super high density of it. Mm. If you think that sugar cube set like sized piece weighs more than 7 billion humans, and then you're trying to pour that into, you'd need like a reinforced planet. You'd have to have the planet on some kind of scaffolding to hold it in place while it took on.
But that's what they have in the movie. They have a scaffold around the big star to power it. Also, I mean, if you're talking like energy to sort of smelt it, I mean, if you don't even just look at it, smelt it in the formation, there's got to be enough an energy in that compression.
Mm.
When it goes mm-hmm. supernova,
yeah,
that causes the sun or the star to just go,
yeah,
down into that size.
So the tricky thing is that. So what you're basically asking is, if I go to a neutron star, can I take a scoop?
Sort of,
right? You know, let's imagine it's a really solid ice cream.
What's the melting point of a neutron star?
I'm not sure it technically has a melting point, because neutron stars are held together by some pretty weird quantum mechanics. And if quantum mechanics wasn't true, then neutron stars wouldn't exist. So it's really weird and difficult to explain in a short set of sentences, so I'm not going to try. Okay. But
yeah, keep it light for us.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep it light, because I don't want to teach
okay,
you.
Okay, okay. How about this? Say we're not using something as dense as a neutron star.
Uh-huh.
Say we are using one of those super dense metals that is meltable or it does have a melting point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what level of energy are we talking about to try and melt like a super dense metal that isn't like a neutron star? I'm assuming it's a big amount, but
it's going to be a lot, right? And I think the clue comes from the kind of the structure that exists around the star in the film, right? This is very reminiscent of what's known in the field as a Dyson sphere. I don't know if that's familiar to you or to anybody listening.
Vaguely.
Right. So a Dyson sphere, the concept of a Dyson sphere is the following, right? So let's imagine that you can do just about anything with matter that's within the laws of physics. And you wanted to build the best solar panel ever, right? And what you would do is, instead of building a small set of panels and collecting a small amount of light, you'd build a panel that was basically a giant sphere that it completely captures a star, right? So the star's in the center, you build a big sheet around it. And
it's all inside it.
And so it's all inside. So all of the radiation that comes out the star, you capture. And the plus thing is that if you get it set up so that you can live on the inside of the sphere, then that's a habitat that's like millions of planets in size, right? So you could have millions of Earth's worth of landmass on this thing. So it's a very good energy collection system. And so what it looks like in the film is like a partial Dyson sphere, in that they're harvesting energy from the star at the same time.
And then focusing it.
And then focusing it in some way. Now, if it's a neutron star, neutron stars produce large amounts of radiation. They also produce lots of magnetic energy. So if you could find ways to focus that, then yeah, I mean, I don't think it would be a problem to do pretty much anything with conventional materials, right?
Okay.
So the problem would be that if you could take a chunk of neutron star matter, is the minute you do that, the neutrons themselves start to become unstable. The reason that they're held together and being stable is because they're part of this really massive collection that's very well squished together. If you take a scoop out, if I could hold like a bunch of neutron star matter in my hands, if I was super strong and I could hold it, what would happen fairly quickly is that the neutrons would decay, and I would get protons and electrons kind of shooting out of my hand, which is bad because protons and electrons are going to shoot into my body and damage my DNA. So let's not do that. But in principle, if you're trying to smelt
a gigantic dwarf,
if you're a gigantic dwarf and you've got super resistant DNA, the problem is that the neutron star matter doesn't stay as neutron star matter for long; it becomes something else, right? So if you could smelt it super quickly, I'm not sure what smelting would mean for neutron stars, but you know, if you could manipulate the metal quickly, maybe you could get it into the right shape. But the minute you'd start wielding this thing as a hammer, it would start turning into something else. So I think this is the point where the science kind of starts to say annoying, snarky things about the fiction.
I see Infinity War, because it's like they obviously have that, they need to get the power up to the right pace. Once it melts pretty quickly, and then they sort of, once it's melted, they literally just pour it in and then you make it. And obviously you can't have a situation where they make a shiny new hammer for Thor and he picks it up and goes, "Oh no, my DNA." It would be a little bit of an anticlimax.
Yeah.
Oh, how did Thor die? Just radiation poisoning.
On the other hand, if you had a bunch of neutron star matter and you wanted to build any element you liked in the periodic table, then theoretically speaking, neutron star matter is great for that, because to build an element, you need protons, neutrons, and electrons. And all you have to do is then just wait for some of your neutrons to turn into protons and electrons, and then just start building elements, right? So you could pick the weirdest element you liked, and you think, well, that's actually what I want to make my hammer out of. Then it's maybe a good place to start. And that's maybe what they mean by forged in the heart of a dying star, is that you take a bit of neutron star stuff, and then you rearrange the constituents.
Scoop.
Yeah. You basically you use that as ingredients for a recipe, and the recipe is whatever metal you want to make. So maybe, but it would require like pretty advanced technology to do that. And it's not something that is even possible on sort of a 100-year timescale for humans. You know, it's very far-fetched stuff. Well, yeah, I mean, if you're some kind of future space dwarf, then, you know, maybe you can do that sort of thing, right?
Who knows what's possible?
Exactly.
See, just when we're on that scene specifically, we've got the moment where Thor holds the eye open so that the beam can get through, and he takes a lot of that blast. Yeah. What kind of levels of energy would that star be giving out? And is it a case of, like, he should have been just obliterated, basically?
Yeah, he should have just been obliterated, right? He's getting dozed with x-rays.
Those arms, those guns.
Gamma rays. he's getting dozed with, you know.
Gamma rays, he's Hulk now.
Yeah, basically. I think these are beyond even what the Hulk would have been irradiated with. But yeah.
You imagine a Thor Hulk.
Oh, his hair would be amazing, though. I mean, I genuinely love that whole scene, because it's such a cool thing to watch. And like, it's just pure sci-fi madness. With the like I said, the gyroscope, which when you start thinking about it, when you make that point of like a Dyson sphere, yeah, it makes perfect sense, because why would you spend the time building an entire dome if you can essentially get the same thing from that gyroscopic effect? Because it's going to be pulling in, you're going to be pulling in a lot of energy from the gyroscope.
Well, I mean, it might well be the case you don't want all the energy; you want some of the energy to escape in some way. And that might also be helpful. I mean, it's hard to speculate, right? You get a few shots of it in the film, and they've clearly not decided in detail what the thing is.
It looks great.
Yeah, it looks cool.
Whether it's practical, I mean,
yeah, obviously.
Again, we're struggling to get off this planet, let alone making hammers out of magical metal from a weird kaleidoscope flamey thing with a man who talks to trees.
This whole thing is that scene in particular is kind of where science and magic kind of intersect, right? Because you've got scientific elements about engineering and smelting and extracting energy from a real kind of star. And then the magic bit is that Thor can somehow survive in the vacuum of space and get blasted by huge amounts of energy and be totally fine. Right. So something is happening there that science just doesn't explain. You have to just go, well, okay, it must be some sort of magic, right? Because it's a comic book film.
Cool. So are we saying that Mjolnir could exist? I mean, it's a long shot.
It certainly couldn't exist by any way that we know of engineering.
Or as described, but like you could essentially get like a super dense metal or super heavy metal. It would just take a lot of energy and a lot of...
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're discovering new elements all the time in the periodic table, and it might well be the case that in the future we could produce new types of metal that fit some of these characteristics. It's not something I can see us doing because it requires a huge amount of... it requires lots of energy, it requires a lot of precision and control, and it also requires us not to be scared of being totally fried by being really close to a very powerful radiator, like a neutron star. So, yeah, I don't think you could rule it out.
Referring to a neutron star, it's just a really powerful radiator.
Yeah, it's true. It emits radiation.
Turn the thermostat down, dude. It's fine.
So, yeah, I mean, it's not ruled out by the laws of physics in some ways, right? But if you make a hammer out of neutron star matter, you're going to have problems.
Unless you've got nails made out of neutron star matter as well.
In which case,
your house is not going to be up to code.
Unless it's made in...
the densest house in the universe!
Built my house. Whoop-boom.
Yeah. Crap. And everyone's destroyed house is planet. Attracted to your house and falling on top of it.
You're coming over. You are now. This is
too late.
Right.
And this is the planet that Jack broke.
What's up, Fair City Podcast? This is Chris and Dan from Fresh Talk. Check us out at freshtalkpodcast.com.
That's right. And if you had any idea how long it took me and Dan to do that bumper, you would actually probably never listen to us.
It's totally true. Get him, Stobie.
Hey, Stobie, it's me, Jarrett. Go to jarrettgoesthemovies.com. Check out the podcast. Also, go to Rockstar Dad Show. Check that one out, too. It's freaking great. They're both great. Also, you just got a text and a Facebook message. Yeah. And I probably better give you this phone back.
Hello, this is Jim.
And my name is Graham Chen Jack.
And we're both responsible for the monstrosity that is A Bloody Mess Podcast.
We can be found at www.facebook.com/messpodcast, twitter.com/mess_podcast, Instagram is A Bloody Mess.
And we're our alternative Wednesdays to the Science of Fiction Podcast, which is a must listen.
Right, so we've talked about the science behind the making of Mjolnir, whatever it's called, Thor's hammer. Stobie, I think you've got some questions about what Thor's hammer can do.
Yes, so I was looking more into the abilities of Thor's hammer, Mjolnir, and found some interesting stuff that has been written in the publications over time. So what's been gathered up is that Mjolnir basically has the ability to create force fields. The more you read about what it's done over the years, and I mean, like say earlier, you know, it's 56 years, the more it just starts to become almost like the most omnipotent inanimate object ever. But it says it can create a force field that's basically been capable of containing an explosion that could potentially destroy a galaxy. So my questions, and it's in three parts, is such an explosion possible? How much power would it generate or require? And is containment even possible? And I believe, Forgan, you had quite a bit of fun with this one.
Yeah, I actually sat and got some paper and pen, did some maths. So There are lots of different ways. I'm going to try and answer your second question, and that will hopefully help me answer the third and the first. So let's figure out how much energy you need. And so it depends what you mean by destroy the galaxy, right? So if it, by destroy it, you mean take all the things that are inside it and move them apart, that would basically require you to produce an explosion with an energy equal to the binding energy of the galaxy. So how much gravitational energy the galaxy has with all the stars collected together. It turns out that most of the gravitational energy of a galaxy is not in the stars. It's not even in the gas between the stars. It's in this weird thing that we don't understand called dark matter that surrounds the entire galaxy.
I've seen that show. It's great.
Yeah. And so we think about 30% of the matter that we call the Milky Way is this kind of standard matter that we're made of, and the rest is this dark matter. So you can look at estimates for what we think the mass of the dark matter that the Milky Way lives in is, and then you can say, okay, well, how much energy would it take? Well, how much energy has it got? And that would tell us how much energy it would take to blow up. And so, okay, right. So we talked about supernovas in the last bit, and a supernova is one of the most powerful explosions in the universe. When a supernova goes off, it's brighter than the host galaxy for several days, right? So you can imagine it's outshining basically billions, hundreds of billions of stars for a couple of days. It's pretty bright. So imagine taking a million of those, get them all to go off at exactly the same time, and get all of that energy, right?
Hold on. So to use a really random example, is it like that weird firework display that went off? Everything went off at the same time.
Okay. Imagine that firework display, but instead of like, you know, a few hundred fireworks, it's a million supernovas.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, that's the perfect analogy, right?
It was like, what happens when a fireworks display just goes all off in like 2 seconds rather than like in a line?
So you've got to harvest all that energy and then dump it into the galaxy, every last bit of that energy, and then that will destroy it. So all the stars will fly apart. All dark matter will fly apart, and the galaxy will never have existed, if you like. You know, it will just disappear. I then asked myself, okay, is this possible? And so it's probably not possible, right? If to get a million stars to go supernova, we have to actually have a million stars capable of going supernova in the galaxy. I did some calculations, and the best estimate I saw was that there's maybe 400,000 stars in the Milky Way that could go supernova at any point. So basically, you have to set off all of them all at the same time. You've got to be able to make sure all of that energy goes into your galaxy, which is no guarantee. And then that stuff will go into the galaxy. All the stars will fly apart or will fly away from each other. And all the dark matter will fly away from each other. And that will be the end of the galaxy.
So it's a really complicated wiring system needed.
Yes. Yes, and so that's if you want to destroy the galaxy in the sense of moving everything that's in it away from each other. If you want to actually like destroy it, as in like take each and every star and destroy all its matter, then that number gets stupidly big, right? I mean, I think it's at the point where you're talking about the amount of energy that existed when the universe was very young. So you may accidentally create a universe while doing it. So don't.
So you've got rid of one universe and just created another.
Well, you've created a universe inside ours, right? And that's potentially very bad because the universe could expand inside ours, and that expansion could destroy more things in the galaxy.
Well, isn't that what we're aiming for?
Well, you could destroy the entire universe. That's the problem. You could basically it's like taking a room and filling it up with a balloon, and the balloon fills the entire room and there's no space for anything left. Right. And that might happen here in this case. I'm not sure exactly. It depends what theory of cosmology you subscribe to. But that's one possible outcome.
Sorry, both me and Sylvia are nodding away going, oh yeah, yeah, we subscribe to, was it string theory, you know,
yeah.
I watch Big Bang Theory.
Okay, there you go.
I subscribed to Cosmopolitan once.
But you can't get off their email list now either.
Nope. Not tried. So with that in mind then, I mean, say such a power was generated, then the power within Mjolnir to stop that must just be near limitless.
Yes.
To be able to, because it would be almost contained into a small space if you think of the size of the hammer.
Mm.
You know, in this case, I can't remember who it was, but somebody was setting off this explosion. And it would have been very tiny in relative terms because it would have been applied from either Asgard or Earth or wherever. Mm. In such a concentrated space, it would just...
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think they never did their maths before they wrote that storyline.
I think maybe they just did themselves up a bit too high. And
I very much doubt there are many sort of astrophysicists who are drawing comics.
Disproved.
Yeah, that might be an issue at this point. I mean, I think it's better in the modern era now that there's more effort to speak to people. And I get requests from people quite a lot saying, oh, we're doing a show or we're doing a documentary and we're asking about, you know, we know that you're an expert in this area. Can we ask you some questions? And so I have helped like develop for, you know, a couple of different different theatre events, different TV shows where they want to try and inject some science into the fiction. So sometimes they come and ask you, right? If you're lucky, they'll speak to you, they'll listen to you, and then you'll see your results in the final shot, which is good.
Sometimes they'll just ignore it and go with what they want anyway because it gives what they think is a better story.
Well, yeah, sometimes you're a killjoy and you're like, nah, that none of this can happen, guys. Sorry, your entire premise is flawed. And they're like, fuck it. They just get on with it.
Another question I had was, it can control electromagnetism.
Mm-hmm.
That took me a few attempts. So, in theory, Thor faces off against Magneto, and they fight magnetism against magnetism, basically. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming electromagnetism is the same thing.
Yeah.
The worst version of Roxas's paper ever.
Well, this was my question. Would it be, like, basically stalemate, or would it be... Well, not stalemate, because it's equal in either sense. Assuming the forces are equal, would it nullify the magnetism, or would it...
Oh, I can see Steve waving his hand in the air. I think we need to let him take it.
I think I actually might be able to sort of possibly answer this, because I'm assuming...
That was well caveated.
assuming that magnetism, it's like, it's the whole polar thing.
Yeah.
And then essentially what would happen is obviously if they're pushing out the same pole, then they would push each other apart, or they're pushing out opposite poles, they would pull each other together. So I'm assuming they would be pushing out the same, like north to north or south to south.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sheerly a case of power. That would be my assumption.
Yeah.
When it comes to that, like who can push out the biggest magnetic field that would repel the other. And if they're equally matched, they're just going to essentially nullify, or not so much nullify, but just sort of resist each other.
That's mostly correct, I think. I think if...
Thank you, kids' TV shows.
So there's two things here, right? There's the strength of the fields, and there's also the shapes, right? And this is kind of touching on the north to north, south to south thing. So you can make magnetic fields incredibly complicated shapes. And I'm assuming that both Thor and Magneto could do that if they chose, right? They could make the magnetic field any shape they liked. And so when those two shapes interact, you can have some pretty difficult to explain things that happen. At this point, you'd basically have to run a really sophisticated computer simulation to find the result, because the equations are very hard to solve. But one of the things we can do is we can look at somewhere where this kind of happens, and this sort of happens on the sun. So the sun's magnetic fields are very complicated, and there's bits kind of interacting with each other, and you get bits of strong field interacting with bits with not so strong field in a different direction.
Is that where you get those sort of like loops? When you see some movies, you get like those loops of energy sort of coming off and then going back into the sun.
Yeah, so what you're seeing there is you're seeing the field and you're seeing particles travel along the field. Yeah? And so they follow the field lines up, out and down. Yeah. So you're right. And so one thing we do see happening in the upper atmosphere of the sun is a phenomenon called magnetic reconnection. And that's basically when the field lines get twisted in such a way that they kind of snap. So they snap and then reattach to some other part of the field. And when you reconnect like that, you release lots of energy. So what I could imagine happening is that Thor and Magneto are like facing off, and like the magnetic fields are getting very complicated. And then one of them figures out how to reconnect against the other. and kind of shoots them with basically a whole bunch of magnetic energy that comes unexpected at random quarters. So it would be an interesting duel, but there could be a winner. And it's really hard to predict from without like asking them to show up and do it.
it really does come down to that whole master of manipulation thing. Like the true master would be able to, I would assume, be able to do stuff like that. Because
yeah, it's who can control the field the most sensitively and understands the shape of it would be the winner.
Do you know, I would probably say, like, power-wise, you might see Mjolnir, whatever his name is, might be able to sort of outpower Magneto, but I think Magneto would have the subtlety and the delicate control.
Yeah.
That's just my theory. Like, I mean, I imagine the hammer would be just brute strength,
yeah.
Whereas I think Magneto would be like, yeah, well, just gonna,
yeah,
like that sort of almost like a fencer, like just picking off, doing stuff like that.
You could imagine them doing some kind of judo, like using power against Thor, and yeah. I can imagine ways that you could, you know, use your field to help reconfigure the other field and, like, you know, work energy around. Magnetic fields are very complicated, right? They're some of the most complicated things in physics. So you could kind of come up with all sorts of scenarios for this.
I was not expecting that, to be honest. I was expecting just a yes or no answer, but this is great. At one point there, I almost imagined, literally, like you said, Stu, the worst game of rock, paper, scissors ever. It's like sort of
rock.
Positive or negative.
Rock.
Positive or negative.
And it's just them being thrown together or thrown apart.
Yeah. Or just working in harmony.
Yeah.
Next thing I was just wanted to ask about was weather manipulation. So it's been known, obviously we know it can bring the thunder, you know, it can bring the storm. If weather manipulation was possible from the surface of the Earth, how would it work?
So we have been trying to manipulate the weather as a species for like the last 50 years. And most of the stuff we've been doing is with cloud seeding. And this goes back to the idea that, so clouds are just water vapor, right? So the water vapor is in the air, and clouds are just that water vapor condensing. So what people have been trying to do is they've been trying to encourage that condensing to happen by basically spraying different kinds of particles. So the way that condensation works is you need these little particles to act as like sites for water to kind of grab onto, so you can help condensation happen. So the idea was that if we just spray different parts of the atmosphere with these particles, then we can encourage clouds to form. We can literally seed clouds. And that actually kind of works, right? I mean, there's been lots of examples that have been done in the past, and it does seem to help produce clouds. It doesn't necessarily increase your chance of having rain or anything like that. It doesn't increase your chance of having thunder, but it certainly lets you produce clouds, right? So, you know, that's obviously quite helpful. In terms of like making a thunderstorm or something like that, to get a thunderstorm to work, you've got to basically create a very big difference in charge between different layers of the cloud. So one part is positively charged and one part is negatively charged. And then all the electrons in the cloud are like, ah, there's a positive charge, and they go traveling down. And that's where you get these lightning strikes, is where it kind of sees an opening and goes, aha, right, I'm going to fire down all my electrons right down to the ground. And so that's what you're seeing during a lightning strike, is the electrons going down through the ground, hitting stuff in the atmosphere as it goes down, and that's what's creating the flash. Doing that means you've got to put a lot of energy into the cloud. So, you know, in the case of Thor's hammer, then it's presumably quite good at generating energy, so maybe that's fine. And all you do is you hold the hammer up, and it kind of says, right, you know, let's give me some electrons, and you get electrons.
Just to kind of, obviously we were talking earlier about if it's a super dense metal and it giving off electrons and protons and stuff like that. I mean, is that potentially something that it is? It's like essentially putting those, I've already forgotten it, electrons into the atmosphere where it's trying to draw the lightning from, and then pulling the lightning down. Could that be something that maybe it's doing?
Well, what you could do is, I mean, the trick is you want your electrons to go towards your positive charge. So you want to create a lot of negative charge at the top of the cloud, a lot of positive charge as you go down the cloud all the way down to the ground. So if you fire electrons up to the top of the cloud and protons down to the ground, then you're creating a big charge difference, and that's what's going to result in your lightning strike.
And at the moment, if I've said it again, if using the hammer is a, if a hammer is essentially a focus, as we've seen in the movies, and it's creating that positive, and or it's a source of the positive charge, and essentially it's sort of giving out the negative charge, or somehow managing to create a negative charge above it, therefore creating that that line essentially where the lightning is. So when we see in the early movies, and he's calling down the thunder into the hammer and then firing it off, I mean, could that be what it is? That it's essentially creating a negative charge in the atmosphere, which is drawn to the positive charge of the hammer, and then focusing the negative charge out.
So you can imagine that while he's trying to draw down the lightning, the hammer is positively charged, and then when he wants to throw it away, he wants to move the lightning away from him, then the hammer must become very negatively charged. And so the electrons see the negative charge and go, ah, I don't like that. And suddenly they go flying out of the hammer towards his target. So that's kind of what you could imagine happening, is that it goes positive and then it goes negative. How it does that is not clear to me, right? But
Magic hammer.
Magic hammer, right? I mean, this is the great thing about this particular episode. It's like, if I don't know what the answer is, like, magic. Dunno.
Dunno, wizard did it.
Yeah, wizard did it. So...
Well, so that's a question, and just thinking on it. So, super dense neutron star, can it conduct electricity?
By itself, it can't, right? So, neutrons are electrically neutral, and there's no charge difference in them at all. You need to have something that was charged in some way, or the ability to charge it. And the best way for that is to turn some of your neutrons into protons, and then you can get some positive charge.
Is that what made, so again, we'll go into a little bit of the theory behind it. Was like, is it possible that essentially the hammer does sort of alternate between positive and protons and neutrons and that sort of thing to then manipulate the atmosphere in that way? I don't know. Is that possible?
Well, I mean, it's certainly true that you can...
Obviously, anyone nearby the hammer while it's doing this would just be like, fall over and die, but...
I mean, it's pretty nasty stuff. You can take a proton, an electron, and you can make a neutron. In the same way, you could take a neutron and split it into a proton and electron. But when you do, you release other particles as well. You release neutrinos. And neutrinos are fine. Like, they don't really interact with matter. So if you hold up your thumbnail, there's about 6 billion neutrinos going through that thumbnail every second. And it's absolutely fine, right? It doesn't interact with you at all. So it's producing lots of what we would consider to be fairly harmless radiation, which is great. You can imagine that, like, if you're going to invoke some sort of like science magic mix, then you could say, well, the hammer is made of a material that can convert from neutrons to protons, or that there's something in the hammer that allows you to go from a proton to a neutron and back, basically collect electrons, take and give them to a proton, make a neutron, and back and forth, and basically manipulate. And if you could do that, then you're manipulating the local charge in your environment, and that would explain why you can manipulate electricity generally, right? So that's a very hand-wavy, like, half past nine at night bullshit explanation for how it works.
Do you know what? I was sitting there going to go, do you want to give us a rough summary of what you think about Monia? But I just think that was a pretty good...
It's not bad, is it?
I think it's a pretty good approximation of how we think Thor's hammer works, maybe a little bit of an understanding behind the science of it, an explanation of some of the things it can do and has done. I think we've done actually pretty well. I mean, do you guys have any final thoughts about it or any ideas?
I think this stuff is still very much fiction, right? I mean, I can't think of how physically any of this... There's lots of inconsistencies, right? Which is not surprising because it's a magic hammer. So it's not going to totally work scientifically, but... you can think about, where does the science come in and where do all the inconsistencies come in along the way? And it's kind of a fun experiment to think about it.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was going
to
say.
I think, and that's what we're sort of here to do really on this podcast, is just sort of have a look at some of those things that we see in all these sort of things. And there's all sorts of stuff we're going to talk about at some point, and just got to go, is it possible? Is it not possible? Does it really matter? It's fun to think about.
Yeah, absolutely.
So with that, I think we've come to the end of this. I've not got any more puns left. So do we want to round up? Do you want to say anything that we'll round off?
Well, where can people find you online, Stu?
Oh, on the internet.
Excellent.
You guys can Forgan. Find me at Barg the Ogre on Twitter. I'm always around. I may at some time bring back Inside the Ogre's Cavern at ITOC podcast. Yeah, that's where I am, but generally.
Excellent.
Forgan. So you can find me on Twitter at DH4GAN, and that's a number 4. DH4GAN.
You can find me at DStoby. If you've got any questions for us, anything that you want to contribute to the discussion, let us know. We'd be happy to get involved. Anything you want us to cover in future episodes, we do have a fully qualified astrophysicist on board.
And 2 morons.
So make the most of it while you can. Yes.
2 fully qualified morons.
You can find more information about us at fcpod.net/thescienceoffiction.
You've been listening to another great podcast from the Fair City Podcast Network, a group dedicated to connecting and developing podcasts. Check out fcpod.net for more great podcasts and content.
Thanks for listening, guys, and we'll be back soon with another one.
Bye.
Cheerio.